Welcome to Broad Appeal After Dark, the podcast that normally looks back at female-driven films from the not-so-distant past, and we're still kind of doing that. I'm Sean.
And I'm Brian.
How are you, Brian?
Well, Sean, I'm here in my glamorous negligee by Ori Kelly, and I'm, you know, sitting on a settee, sipping some...
poppers.
This really is After Dark. I feel like, ladies and gentlemen, this is a special treat of a Broad Appeal episode. Of course, as you know, we are magnificently obsessed with female-driven films. We are also magnificently obsessed with recording podcasts. So we couldn't possibly let a two-week window go by without seeing you, without you having us inside your ears. But Sean, it has been a busy autumn.
It has. We finished our series of 1987 Oscars.
If you haven't listened to those, go back, listen to them. They're all gems.
Yeah. We had Broad Appeal Live, which was, I guess, a total success.
The audio of that will be on its way soon. You've had a busy year of film programming, film jurying.
And then just day jobbing, as everyone else does.
As everyone else does. But no, Sean, I guess the reason that we've decided to dedicate this little special one-off episode is because of a series that you have programmed at the Cinema Museum in Kennington. Londoners, if you have never been to the Cinema Museum, what are you waiting for?
Yeah, it's a legendary venue that you're never going to forget. When you walk into the upstairs space and see this outline of Charlie Chaplin and all this cinema memorabilia in this huge... high-ceilinged room, you're going to think, oh my god, how did I not know about this?
It's a bit like if Miss Havisham was, like, obsessed with old Hollywood. Curios and cobwebbed movie posters kind of hanging around everywhere, each little nook and cranny filled with some sort of Betty Davis or Jane Wyman, you know, little treasure.
Yeah.
It really is. It's quite an amazing place, full of atmosphere.
Yeah, it is. And I used to run an event there once a month for 3.5 years called The Veto Project, which focused primarily on LGBT films.
Yeah, so definitely, if you live in London, you're in London, check out what the Cinema Museum has programmed. But over the last couple of months, their program has included some films that were hand-selected by you, Sean. And so...
yes, there was no robots involved.
There were no robots. Absolutely, you know, no forks or implements were used. He just picked them with his very own hands, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes.
But I thought it would be fun because you sort of two-thirds of the way through the films in that program. I think one of them is airing that the night that this episode comes out, and then there's a couple more left. It'd be fun for me to kind of pick your brains about why you programmed this series, what it's all about, what your discoveries have been, because it's fair to say, isn't it, that the films of Ross Hunter are nearly all Broad Appeal classics because they're female-centered films from the rather distant past.
Mm.
Yes?
Yes.
Am I right? They're all basically female leads.
Well, you know, as cinema is a very new art form in the grand scheme of things, you could say it's all recent past.
Yes, no, I guess so. But,
I'm not going to be pedantic about
it. Some are more recent than others.
Yeah.
But, you know, you and I, as listeners of this podcast know, are a couple. You could argue we were brought together by OkCupid, but I could say...
it was a genie's curse that brought us together.
Well, it might have been a genie's curse, and that genie might have been named Ross Hunter. You know? Is it fair to say that you and I found each other... but little did we know the impact that gay Hollywood producer Ross Hunter had had on both of our lives.
Okay, well, I'm going to just, you know, ratchet that down a little bit, okay?
Exaggeration is very much in the spirit of Ross Hunter's aesthetic.
Yes, well, Ross Hunter didn't want to hold a mirror up to the world we live in, did he? He didn't want to see that whatsoever.
He just wanted to show the parts of life that he found the most attractive.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we probably need to explain a bit who Ross Hunter
okay.
is.
Okay. So, it turns out Ross Hunter was a producer who you and I were both very familiar with. Only the names and the oeuvre were not something that we could list off the top of our heads like we can do now. Ross Hunter was an openly gay, and by openly gay I mean lots of people knew, but the ordinary folks didn't need to.
Like an open secret, kind of.
Yeah. In the same way, the studio had a terrible time keeping Rock Hudson under wraps. Everyone knew he was gay. They were just desperately trying not for every single person to know he was gay.
Mm-hmm.
So Ross Hunter was a very successful, very accomplished Hollywood film producer who had a lot of hits that a lot of people loved. A lot of them got plenty of Oscar nominations, too. And it turns out that some of my favorite films and some of your favorite films were produced by this man.
Yeah, so just help us with context here. What years are we talking about?
We're talking about 1950 to 1970.
And what studio?
Universal.
Okay, so for those who aren't like students of classic Hollywood, in the rankings of the studios, where does Universal kind of fall?
Oh, at the bottom. It was the bargain basement. Right. It was the bargain basement of all the studios.
You've got,
obviously,
like,
ones like RKO did not continue to...
Right,
yeah.
So RKO was more in the 30s and 40s.
Yeah.
But, like, at the pinnacle, you've got your...
You got your 20th Century Fox,
your MGM, Paramounts.
Yeah, Paramount. Yeah. Yeah.
And kind of going down the food chain, by this point, Universal made its reputation decades before from making horror films. Is
oh,
that
yeah.
right?
Oh, yeah. The yeah. Wolfman, Dracula.
Right. By the time of Ross Hunter's career... He was working primarily in which modes of movie?
Well, he would be making women's pictures, melodramas. Mm. But, you know, he also made action films like Taza, Son of Cochise, which we all know.
Taza.
Yeah, except this film featured Rock Hudson in, like, a barely there loincloth.
Really?
Yes.
I'm doing a Google image search.
See him?
Ooh.
All slicked up.
He's also got a lot of dark foundation all over his torso.
Yes, I think this may be red face.
This is bad. This is very bad.
Just because something is bad doesn't mean that we have to erase it from history.
Well, okay, so no doubt Ross Hunter was enjoying dabbing Rock Hudson in foundation all over his body, but like... Okay, you've jumped ahead to some of the movies. So, like, you say that you and I were familiar with Ross Hunter's filmography
yes.
without knowing it.
Yes. You want evidence?
Yeah. What's the evidence?
Well, for you, it's Thoroughly Modern Millie.
Yes. So, ladies and gentlemen, have you seen Thoroughly Modern Millie?
You can, tonight.
Yeah, come see it.
7:30, Cinema Museum.
What's the date of tonight?
Today.
Which is what?
Whatever.
The 6th of December.
Whatever day this comes out.
It's the 6th of December.
The 6th of December.
Thursday the 6th of December, 7:30 at the Cinema Museum. Save yourself a good 2 hours plus, because this is one of those 60s musicals that is like... way longer than it needs to be.
Well, it turns out actually it's 2 hours and 8 minutes. For some reason, when I picked up the DVD box, I was like holding my breath. It was going to be like 3 hours and 47 minutes.
It does feel long, but it also it
but
has,
it's very entertaining, it's and you should come.
No, it really is super entertaining. It's one of those movies that has an interval.
Yeah.
So there's an intermission. I have to say, like Thoroughly Modern Millie, there are a few movies that I have seen so many times that I can quote them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a pretty depressing list. It goes from the high water mark of quality of like Howard's End down to the good quality but problematic politics of Gone with the Wind to the screwball fun of Bringing a Baby and then Thoroughly Modern Millie. Those four films are probably the ones that I've seen more than any others, like repeatedly.
You know what mine are?
What?
Moonstruck.
Mm-hmm.
Death Becomes Her.
Mm-hmm.
And the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Well, it's no wonder that we ended up together, is it really? But the reason... So my reason for having seen Thoroughly Modern Millie in the first place... I don't know if I've ever told you this. In summer camp, to know how old I was, we were doing a production of the classic 1920s musical parody, The Boyfriend.
Now, during this time, was there a masked slasher killing people?
No.
Okay.
What, in summer? I know what you did last summer.
Or any of Friday the 13th.
No, nothing like that. We just put on musicals, okay? So I, for a number of years, every summer I would be in summer camp, and there would be all sorts of arts activities, but one would always be putting on a musical. This was when I did West Side Story. This was when I did Little Shop of Horrors. But one year...
I'm so jealous, by the way.
Well, what can I
say?
This
is an American childhood.
I always got cast as an old man. In both of those musicals that I just mentioned, I was cast as Doc, the old man who runs the drugstore. I was cast as Mr. Mushnick. And then in The Boyfriend, I was cast as an aging British aristocrat with a taste for young flesh. Sur la plage on the French Riviera.
So you played a cannibal?
I played somebody named Lord somebody or other, and he has a song called "It's Never Too Late to Have a Fling, for autumn is just as nice as spring, and it's never too late to fall in love." There's a Ken Russell film of The Boyfriend.
Oh, yeah, I know, starring Janet Jackson. Twiggy.
No, Twiggy, yeah. Anyway, so The Boyfriend is a very tongue-in-cheek musical spoof of the 1920s, but I remember the director telling us, you know, oh, let's learn about the 1920s. And she showed us some, like, clips.
Wow, from, like, she's a great shooter.
Well, she was a summer camp musical director, but she showed us a few clips of, like, things set in the 1920s. I remember we saw the Varsity Rag from some, like, MGM musical. And then one of them was the Tapioca from Thoroughly Modern Millie. And I was like, oh my god, this movie has Julie Andrews in it, Mary Poppins. I just clearly responded to this material. I came home from summer camp and I was like, can we rent Thoroughly Modern Millie? And Sean, my god, I don't know if I've ever responded to a movie like more immediately. I bought the VHS, and then this movie stayed in my family's library downstairs in the basement, and it became, bizarrely, for reasons that I don't know, our Thanksgiving viewing year on and year out. Year in and year out. So whenever, like, my distant cousins or my stepmother's cousins or people would come over, they'd be like, let's watch Thoroughly Modern Millie, because one year I suggested we watched it. And we would watch it. I mean, like, years and years went by of watching it on a regular basis.
Now, where is this VHS right now?
This VHS right now is in the next room.
I know.
But we don't have a VCR, but it doesn't matter because I don't need to watch Thoroughly Modern Millie again. I mean, I will come tonight to the Cinema Museum, but I do not need to watch it again because it is imprinted on my eyeballs.
Well, let me tell you about my first memory of seeing it. I can remember it exactly. It was like a Saturday afternoon and it came on RTE1 or something. And I remember my mother saying, oh my god, this film is so fun, we'll watch it. And I remember the opening number of it so well.
Describe the opening number.
Well, first of all, it starts off with a pile of newspapers saying, white girls sold into slavery.
Yes, innocent and then girls it says, sold into white slavery.
And then it says, Ross Hunter presents.
tell the audience who the three female leads of Thoroughly Modern Millie are.
Julie Andrews.
Mm-hmm.
Mary Tyler Moore.
Mm-hmm.
And Carol Channing.
Oh my god, like, how could you go wrong with that?
Well...
So your mother said it was fun.
She didn't have any of the same reverence that she had for, say, The Sound of Music.
No, because it's an irreverent... Like, The Sound of Music is like...
Well, you don't like The Sound of Music.
No, I do not like The Sound of Music.
Whereas I quite like The Sound of Music. I like it a lot.
For what reason?
I think it's a very powerful story about...
A powerful story?
About showing Nazis what's what.
It's treacle. Utter treacle.
It is not. You know that point where the Captain Von Trapp says to Rolf, you're better than this. And Rolf turns out to be not better than this. I hope Rolf died a bloody death.
How do they stand up to the Nazis? They don't stay in Austria and join the resistance. They go to America and they open up a fucking bed and breakfast in Vermont.
Well, that's neither here nor there.
I know, it's not. Anyway,
I'm not
a big fan of The Sound of Music, but I am a huge fan of Thoroughly Modern Millie.
What I was trying to say is, you know that scene where she goes in and gets a new bra?
Millie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At the very first 2 seconds
well,
of
because
it.
she begins, she's like dressed in like ankle-length skirts. You know, she's like basically in a like turn-of-the-century matronly, she has long hair, she has a like fuddy-duddy hat, she's just come to town. And she realizes, like, the fashions of the 20s are to toss your cares and curls away. So she goes to the madcap beauty spot, and then she goes to the silhouette shop.
Yes, but I'm trying to talk about my experience here.
I'm just giving you the facts, darling. So she goes in to get a new bra.
Yes.
But
I remember my mother saying, explaining to me, does something, why it was funny, was because something was wrong with her bosom.
Yeah, well, no. So
well, because her beads are kind of... So basically, every young woman is wearing beads now. But because of the whatever kind of brassiere that she's wearing, her, or no brassiere.
Explain your version of it, and then I'll give you the fact check.
Is she wearing a petticoat or something?
At the beginning. So the first thing she does, she gets a haircut.
And she gets a bra.
She gets a short haircut. But then she sees all these girls wearing beads.
Yeah.
And one of the more delightful aspects of Thriller Modern Millie is that periodically Julie Andrews stares right to the camera, mm-hmm. and they do these like silent movie techniques where a little title card appears. And the first one says, "Gosh, I wish my fronts weren't so full. It sure messes up the line of your beads." And so then she walks into a, like, the silhouette shop to get, like, a new brassiere that's going to, like, restrain her bosoms. Because the silhouette of the time was to be quite
yeah.
svelte and flat-chested. And it works for a while, and she has a vampish, you know, walk down the street. But then when she goes to buy a newspaper, the brassiere just pops and her boobs like pop out, and the man selling the newspaper gives like a funny look.
Well, they don't exactly pop out, but
they,
yes.
they literally do, Sean.
No,
pop out.
No, tits. Her tits do not appear on
Watch
camera.
Watch it tonight.
This is an SOB,
it's,
darling.
No, it's some stunt. No, but literally, I'm sure they had some like inflatable thing in Julie Andrews' chest that just like pops.
Anyway, Ross Hunter. Okay, yes. Now this, you made this all about you once again. Let's bring it back to what I'm doing.
It's not all about me, it's about Julie Andrews.
So, the film in which I was very involved with Ross Hunter was Imitation of Life. In fact, it was a variety, in a selection of Douglas Sirk films. He made 10 of them in total with him. Douglas Sirk is up there, interestingly, with Paul Verhoeven as probably my favourite director. Does that make sense?
I guess it makes total sense. You love an expatriate Northern European who comes to Hollywood and then subverts genre.
Yeah, you're absolutely
That's what
right.
those two men have in common.
Yeah, and that's my thing.
With an ironic Northern European gaze upon capitalism.
You're right. That is actually entirely my taste in films.
Oh, yeah. It's yeah. obvious.
Oh, thanks, babe. Thanks for being so astute.
Don't need to thank me. It's just obvious. So, tell everybody a bit about Douglas Sirk.
Oh my god, there's a movie about his life that's waiting to be made. Let me just tell you that. But Douglas Sirk was an emigre who fled Nazi Germany. During World War II, when so many of the young directors and actors and everybody involved in film production had to go to fight, basically,
mm-hmm.
The studios were still making movies and they didn't have enough labor to do it. But they knew that this guy, Douglas Sirk, was living in the San Fernando Valley on a chicken farm. And they
from having escaped,
yeah, and
Nazis.
They were, yeah, and they
wait,
were,
he was a leftist, was he?
Well, yeah, I mean, like every, I guess everybody who opposed the Nazis was in a sense a leftist, but he just knew what was right and what was wrong and what was good and what was bad, and he was married to a Jewish woman as well.
Mm-hmm.
They were living in the San Fernando Valley on a chicken farm, and basically they knew that he was there and they knew that he could make movies, and they were like, okay, can you please come and can you help us out? And so he was actually desperate for work at that point because he hadn't made a film in so long, and he started off making a little kind of B pictures for Universal, and then he started collaborating with this one guy called Ross Hunter. They made a few kind of like, you know, like better than average teen family women's pictures, all round B movie hits that I guess we would look at now and see a particular amount of verve and style and technique. Hunter and Sirk realized they had a very good working relationship. Sirk has this amazing kind of Brechtian sense of capturing the aloofness and the lie of the American way. He was also in love with the American way as well, but he looked at it entirely from an outsider's, an European outsider's perspective. So he was ready to see through the lie, to frame everybody behind bars or in front of screens to show the fallacy of this Western imperialist culture. Whereas Ross Hunter was just in love with the movies.
And also like, and he's in love with gowns,
yeah, and diamonds, and women,
and decor.
Yeah, all the things that he thought were the magic and excess of cinema. And the two of them, it's very interesting because, you know, people who are scholars of Douglas Sirk often cite Written on the Wind and The Tarnished Angels as his best films, and they are the films that he did not make with Ross Hunter.
Mm-hmm.
However, when it comes to the films that have had the most lasting legacy in terms of style, technique, and emotional response, you think of films like All That Heaven Allows, Magnificent Obsession, and Imitation of Life, which was their last collaboration together and Sirk's last film in Hollywood.
Well, you know, I think what's so fascinating, because like, anybody who's a current queer cinephile, right? If you love the films of Todd Haynes, if you love Fassbinder, you know Douglas Sirk's movies even if you don't know them, right? Because there's a whole kind of school for decades of queer moviegoers who have been in love with the films of Douglas Sirk. They're high melodrama, yeah?
Yeah.
So when you watch things like Far From Heaven or Ali, Fear Eats the Soul, they're self-conscious homages to Douglas Sirk. And he has become a kind of cinephile's pet director for many decades now, where people like love to analyze these films, which were maybe dismissed as kind of commercial at the time, but have now come to be appreciated. Now, we actually covered Written on the Wind years ago in one of our series on The Male Gaze, which has Rock Hudson in it and has Robert Stack. We loved that film, and I mean,
I love it.
Introduced it to me. But what I find interesting is, like, in all the like auteurist coverage of Sirk and Sirk's kind of amazing use of genre and subverting genre, and as you say, subverting American tropes, right? How often have you ever read about the role of producer Ross Hunter?
This is, we're finally bringing it back to the point of this.
Yeah.
Which is that this man, who was without doubt a massive success in Hollywood, has been ignored since his death and since he stopped making films as well. He died in 1996. If you Google him, you get loads of obituaries. You get a few videos, home movies.
Yeah, like all his glamorous parties with, you know, Tab Hunter and Rock Hudson and
Lana Turner.
Of closeted gay Demi Monde, Natalie Wood.
But even those are short and without sound. And, of course, you get his filmography as well, which is very
also,
rich.
Apparently his home was a kind of architectural marvel of, like, California modernism. It kind of, some of the Googling I did when you first started getting involved in this series, he's pouring another drink, folks.
This is Broad Appeal After Dark.
It is like Lana Turner. I feel that I'm Sandra Dee. Anyway, but if you find out about Ross Hunter's home, it's like still considered to be, thank you, a kind of great exemplar of a certain kind of California style of like open plan modernism. And it looks, from the images that I've seen, it looks like the set of one of these Douglas Sirk melodramas, you know, with these kind of like columns framing things and like fountains and just kind of like mid-century decor that would be out of like those scenes in Mad Men where Don Draper goes to LA.
Well, yes, that's exactly what you told me about before I saw any pictures of it, and it does seem to be very reminiscent of it. But let me talk a little bit about Ross Hunter for a moment.
Yeah, go ahead.
So we talked about how Ross Hunter's films were already in our lives, so let's get to the point of where Ross Hunter came back into our lives.
Did you see Imitation of Life when you were in university?
Yes, I did, but it wasn't actually one of the texts or one of the films that were on our course. All That Heaven Allows was one of the films that was on my first year course, but there was a strike at one point, like a teacher strike during my first year, and All That Heaven Allows was not screened. We didn't have the lecture on it, and it wasn't included on the final exam. I often find it funny that, you know, had I seen this film in the first 3 months of university like I was supposed to, and not in the last 6 months of my final year, maybe I would have embraced melodrama much faster. Maybe I would have dedicated myself to studying it a lot more while I was still an undergrad. I mean, everything worked out.
So what happened? You finally then saw All That Heaven Allows.
Yeah, I watched,
and that led you to one film after the next.
Yeah, I watched it. I rented it from Laser, which was an amazing art house DVD rental shop in Ranelagh, where I was living, which is now defunct, sadly. And I watched it in my bedroom on my computer, which I don't do anymore. We watch things on a projector. And I cried so much.
At All That Heaven Allows?
At Imitation of Life.
Okay.
And I texted my mother and told her all about it.
So, wait. So, All That Heaven Allows was assigned.
Yeah.
You liked that.
Yeah.
And then you said, I need to see more of these movies. I gotcha.
But Imitation of Life really pushed me over the edge.
Yeah. Do you know when I first saw Imitation of Life?
Yeah, you were in school. I believe it was on the Disney Channel all the time.
That's right. For some reason, the Disney Channel, which mostly showed Disney movies and cartoons and things, in the middle of the afternoon, they would sometimes show old classic movies, and I just started watching Imitation of Life, and I swear I saw it multiple times. And then, at some point in middle school, I was probably in like 7th grade, we had to present on some sort of social issue. And I was like, I'm going to address racism. Now, at the time, it's not as if I was like completely out of it. I was actually reading the autobiography of Malcolm X at the time.
Wait, what is seventh grade? How old are you?
In seventh grade, you're like 13.
You were reading the autobiography of Madame X.
No, we'll get to Madame X. No, I was reading the autobiography of Malcolm X, but that was because...
At 13!
But that was because the Spike Lee film of Malcolm X had come out, and I was actually...
But Brian, you were very precocious.
Well, that movie was a big deal, but I was actually ostracized in my mostly white suburban Massachusetts school. People said, why are you reading this book about black people?
Mm.
This is serious. This is real.
Really?
But anyway, so I was reading the autobiography of Malcolm X, but then when it came time to present at a socialist, I was like, I'll present about something about racism. What about that movie that I've seen on the Disney Channel, Imitation of Life? Because that's about racism.
Brian, if I was your teacher, I would have just, like, I would have called up your parents and said, take care of this one. He's going to be president one day.
President of the Academy. So, no, but honestly, I gave a presentation in seventh grade in which I showed a highlight reel from Imitation of Life.
How did you make it? To make it
yourself? I made it by, like, taking the VHS and, like...
Just pressing record at certain times.
Yeah, pressing record at certain times, and, like, I totally clearly captured the famous bongo drum rape sequence. Is it a bongo drum? What is it?
Well, it's not rape.
But it's like an assault.
It's an assault.
Where Susan Conner... I mean, we haven't explained the plot of Imitation of Life. We'll get to it. But, like, it's... There's something really visceral...
Our listeners aren't idiots. They know what it is.
There's something really visceral about the style of this movie that just, like... I don't know. Even to my, like, 12, 13-year-old self, it, like, cut through that this was, like, pure emotion, pure sadness and melodrama and injustice... but conveyed through artifice.
Yeah, and spectacular artifice.
But this is what I'm saying, and this is why I think the queerness of all of this is so interesting. It clearly spoke to you in university. It spoke to me in middle school. It spoke to Todd Haynes when he was studying semiotics. It spoke to Rainer Werner Fassbinder post-war Germany.
It spoke to Wash Westmoreland, too.
Yeah, but it's so funny because these are movies about women, primarily, like, suffering domestic lives, and yet here are these kind of, like, gay boys who are, like, finding something in the excess and the emotion of it. And I can't help but thinking that it has something to do, yes, with Douglas Sirk's artistry, but also with the fact that there was this campy gay producer, Ross Hunter, who was involved.
Well, you know, Brian, everything I've learned about the world, I've learned from the movies. Everything. Mm-hmm. And cinema...
What would the Catholic Church have to say about that?
Well, the index is a very long list. I can't wait to go through every single one of them. Cinema has taught me how to understand the plight and pain and life of people who I am not.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why it is my first love and always will be. But the thing about Imitation of Life, like you've just said, is that anybody who is capable of empathy and identification, and especially a queer viewer, they look at that film and they think of how Susan Conner's Sarah Jane occupies space and how she can pass safely through many spaces until those instances in which she thinks she's out of the woods and somebody comes up to her and says, I know what you are.
Just tell me one thing.
Yes?
Is it true?
Is what true?
Is your mother a nigger? Tell me. Tell me!
What difference does it make? You love me.
All the kids talking behind my back.
Is it true?
No.
Are you black?
No, I'm as white as you.
You're lying!
I'm not!
You're lying!
And now, you and I are openly gay men living in London and living our best lives. But we've all gone through periods of our adolescence. I mean, we've all been in rooms and KFCs, mm-hmm, and all these places in which suddenly we have to straighten up.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to be conscious of where we are and how we're interacting to people as a safety mechanism and as a survival mechanism. And any queer person who looks at that and sees a young black woman who can pass for white and the trauma and suffering and prejudice and internal quest for something better if you are a queer person and you look at that and you don't empathize, just go sort yourself out.
I agree with you. So you recently screened the film again as part of the Cinema Museum series. It was the first film, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And the response from the audience was...
Well, it was great. It was quite palpable. It was one of those ones where the moment it ended, the lights went up, people went...
Well, yeah, of course, because it's Imitation of Fucking Life. Now, Here's my question. Is Imitation of Life your favorite Douglas Sirk?
I have two joint favorites.
Written on the Wind is the other one.
And then, yeah. But for different reasons.
Is it your favorite Ross Hunter, then?
Well, here's the thing. I love these Ross Hunter films.
Okay, we'll get to all of them, but let's be honest. Like, Imitation of Life is the jewel in the crown of Ross Hunter's filmography in more ways than one.
Yes. No,
how does it begin?
It begins diamonds.
Tell the audience.
So it begins with a beautiful title sequence with the same font that Pillow Talk has, I noticed. Same font. And diamonds just falling slowly, and they fill the screen.
Does it have any purpose, or is it just because Ross likes diamonds?
Well,
I mean, it is related to the plot.
Well, she wears a lot of diamonds.
So beautiful title sequence. Now, the Universal Imitation of Life with Lana Turner was actually a remake, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Of an earlier film with Claudette Colbert.
Yeah, no.
Is it a Fanny Hurst novel?
Yes, it was. Okay. Very good, Brian.
The great Fanny Hurst. She wrote a bunch of potboilers that were made into movies, Ship of Fools being one of the other ones. So I've never... Have you ever seen that 30s one?
No, my friend Rob has.
Is it any good?
Well...
We don't know.
It's very different.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, sketch for some of our... Because some of our listeners, you know, the oldest movie they've ever seen is like, you know...
Pretty Woman.
Yeah. Or even like The Devil Wears Prada. but no. Sorry, listeners. We love you. But,
we love you.
Watch some movies from the 50s. Maybe even some Silence. But anyway, so sketch for them the basic plot of Imitation of Life, because it has two plots,
yeah,
doesn't it?
I'm really quick at doing it these days.
Go.
Two plots. Two women. One, Lana Turner, wants to be an actress, single mother, has a child. The other, Annie, played by Juanita Moore, black woman, has a daughter, Susan Conner. Susan Conner, well, she's played by a child initially, can pass for white. The two of them live together, and Lana Turner becomes a big success.
Mm-hmm.
Miss Laura Meredith. Before we go into it any further, I want to take a sidebar and say, don't tell me Douglas Sirk doesn't have a sense of humor, because the plays that she stars in are things called Laughter, Always Laughing, So Much Laughter, and then later on when she becomes a serious actress in a serious play, it's called No More Laughter.
That's even better than Aged in Wood.
Aged in Wood. Aged in Wood.
Carry on. Because I have to admit to you, Sean, I saw Imitation of Life numerous times for my Disney Channel viewing. I couldn't tell you a single thing that happens in the Lana Turner plot. I have literally forgotten it. But the images of the Juanita Moore and Susan Conner plot,
they're indelible.
The race plot,
yeah,
are like seared on my mind. So, like, but I assume that 50s audiences went for Lana Turner, they went for Sandra Dee, they went for the romance, they went for John Gavin.
Yeah.
And then they were kind of, it's like a Trojan horse thing, isn't it? They were, like, subtly,
well, yes,
then bombarded with this racial plotline.
Well, here's
is
the thing.
Right?
Well, yes, they were, but whether or not it made any impact to them, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I really don't know. Although it does tell you something, that the two acting nominations for that film were Susan Conner and Juanita Moore.
Juanita Moore got an Oscar,
yeah,
nomination.
And you know what else, Brian? In that year,
1959...
In the Best Supporting Actress category, which there are five nominees,
mm-hmm,
three of them were Ross Hunter women.
Who were they?
Juanita Moore, Susan Conner, and Thelma fucking Ritter.
In what?
Pillow Talk.
Wait, he released Imitation of Life and Pillow Talk
in the same year. Yes. Did any of them get Best Picture nominations, Brian? No. Why?
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Because
he was a fag. Now, I have no proof of this, but this is a line I'm going to go down and investigate my new book.
So that's interesting, your forthcoming book from Verso. No, but No, but Tashin. It's from Tashin, everybody. Full of glamorous pictures.
It's Fourth Estate. This is going to be paid for by Murdoch.
But listen to me. So, yes, okay, arguably he wasn't as successful as he could have been because people knew he was a fag. But also, these are in somewhat disreputable and discredited genres. Like, it's quite amazing that the acting was well-regarded enough to have garnered those three supporting actress nominations.
And one best actress for the same year, Doris Day.
Great. Amazing.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is, like, women's pictures, romantic comedy, these are not the kind of things that are considered to be lots of prestige, yeah. Right? These are the genres that Ross Hunter devoted himself yeah. to, right?
You know, we haven't talked about who Ross Hunter is,
well,
but
no.
Ross Hunter was born Martin Terry Fuss.
In always causing a fuss.
Always causing a fuss. Diana Fuss, great feminist writer, also great drag queen name.
Diana Fuss.
Diana Fuss. I'm Diana Fuss, baby. Anyway, born Martin Terry Fuss in Ohio, was a school teacher, and he was a pretty boy, even though, I mean...
He was a twink.
He was a twink. He was a pretty boy, and his students actually all thought he was pretty, and the apocryphal story seems to be that his students sent a picture of him as a headshot to Paramount Studios, in which he went to have a test screening for, which was unsuccessful. However, he was picked up at Universal, as in the bargain bin, mm-hmm. and he starred in a couple of C movies. And that was basically his career as an actor over.
Mm-hmm.
But Ross Hunter, as we know, was in love with the movies. I have described Ross Hunter as a proto Ryan Murphy.
Yes, that makes so much sense.
Yeah, and what, by that what I mean is that Ryan Murphy is in love with TV, and he's in love with movies, and he's in love with
women actresses,
and things that wow. they have made. And he's into all these things. Mm-hmm. And Ross Hunter was no different. He was like, well, I didn't make it as an actor. What am I going to do? Give up on the movies? Give up on the thing that I love? No way. So he started making films in the production side of things. Probably started off as like a script editor.
He was like a set decorator.
Yeah.
His sense of aesthetics and his eventual like long-term partner and boyfriend was an art director.
Yeah. And he was with him until his death.
Yeah. Jacques Mapes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, essentially, Ross Hunter was like, I'm in Hollywood, this is my job, and I'm going to start making movies. And so he worked his way up from set decorator to producer, and the films that he made were very often remakes.
Mm.
So obviously, Imitation of Life was a remake, and Madam X was a remake, which we'll talk about later. And there were other things. He was just interested, like, and actually, I can totally understand why he did this. Because you think of it, you go and see a film, Brian, and you have this decadent, decorous memory of it, and you have all the emotions, you know, that you can pull to the front of your memory like that, okay? And then you see the film years later, and it's like, oh yeah, but actually, I prefer my version. In the case of Ross Hunter, it's like, wait, I can make my version.
Well, and also, I can... Probably his memories were in black and white.
Yeah.
Now I can make them in...
Glorious Technicolor!
CinemaScope. You and I... So the name Ross Hunter meant something to me because I saw Thoroughly Modern Millie so many times that I surely had seen the name.
Sidebar. Do you know what's interesting? On the back of the DVD box, you know the way the director is always the last name in the credits? On the DVD box... The director is second last, and Ross Hunter's name
is last. Actually, the director of Thoroughly Modern Millie is quite acclaimed. It's George Roy Hill, who also directed The Sting and Butch Cassidy.
But that's not his movie. It's Ross Hunter's movie.
No, this is a Ross Hunter film. It's actually kind of crazy that Thoroughly Modern Millie and Butch Cassidy were directed by the same person.
Yeah.
But anyway, so yeah, I certainly knew Ross Hunter's name from having watched Thoroughly Modern Millie so many times. But there was a moment, Sean, that was... fundamentally definitive in our relationship, where Ross Hunter literally got into bed with us.
Oh, yeah.
Tell our listeners.
I'll tell them. Well, so the first present that you ever gave me for Christmas, Brian,
mm-hmm.
was a book that changed my life.
Notice that, ladies and gentlemen, Brian has excellent taste in Christmas presents.
Yeah, so that book was Pictures at a Revolution by Mark Harris, which was a wonderful and essential an entertaining book for you to read, which is about the 1968 Academy Awards and the films which were nominated for Best Picture, and them representing the old guard and the avant-garde.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, if you like our podcast and you have not read Pictures at a Revolution by Mark Harris, what are you waiting for?
Buy it now.
No, honestly, it's maybe one of the best, like, histories of movie making I've ever read, and because it combines very astute commentary and history and in-depth interviews with the makers of the films with a kind of film fans attitude to movies,
which as far as I'm concerned is what you need when you write anything about film.
It's like the mixture of the high and the low.
Film is entertainment, and that book is entertaining, and it was so well researched that, you know, Mark Harris included so many peripheral moments that were just enjoyable to read. And so I can't remember what section it was, but I do remember it was about Peter Shaffer.
Playwright.
Yeah. So Peter Shaffer, who I believe was a homo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A bit, like, conflicted about it.
Yeah. So he was working with Ross Hunter, and he's basically adapting his own play. Because he had Ross Hunter involved, he was kind of subject to the whims and whimsies
of this like, dippy queen.
Yeah. Yes. And so he was like, oh, she's not going to like this. She's not going to like this line. So he would go back to it, and he would say, she appears at the top of the stairs, gown resplendent, dripping in diamonds. I'd be like, that'll keep her happy. And we read this, and we cackled out loud, and we turned to each other, and we said, who is this person?
But, I mean, quickly, we realized that Ross Hunter had been responsible for two of the seminal films of our individual lives and our collective lives, with Imitation of Life and Thoroughly Modern Millie, as well as numerous Cirque films, Pillow Talk, the entire career of Rock Hudson.
And the whole disaster movie as we know it.
Yeah, so this is the thing, Sean, like, from that moment on, from reading the Mark Harris book, I think we both knew that Ross Hunter was a fascinating, overlooked figure in Hollywood, and it's now culminated in you programming this series at the Cinema Museum. So, what have you screened so far, and what have you learned from it?
Well, what I've screened so far, we started off with the Cirque films, and then we had Pillow Talk last week. What I've learned is that Ross Hunter is definitely a person whose taste and instincts need to work in conjunction with someone who can manage him.
Mm.
I think Pillow Talk is an absolutely iconic film. I think it is fresh, and it is stylish, and it is funny, and it is gorgeous. And we saw it on an amazing, really, really crisp Blu-ray print. And if you haven't seen Pillow Talk, you need to make it your imperative to go and see it.
Describe the premise.
Essentially, Rock Hudson is a loutish playboy called Brad Allen. Doris Day is an uptight career woman called Jan Morrow. They share a party line, which is film history in itself. Party line where you couldn't have a private line to yourself, you had to share it with someone else.
My grandmother had a party line.
Yeah.
Did yours?
No. Well, I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, listen, in Ireland, they probably didn't have phones until much later.
Carrier pigeons to one another.
She went down the road and knocked on their door. Sure, who would you be talking to now in a different parish?
Carry on, Pillow Talk.
Anyway, essentially, long, long story of masquerading identities and lies, which ends up in, as screwball comedies tend to do, the sexual normalization of the female character.
Meaning that she is resisting male attention.
Yes.
And then she kind of wants it.
She's resisting it, or something is wrong with her.
It's funny because actually I think the 30s screwball heroines are much more like pursuing men outright. Like,
yeah,
if you think of Bring a Baby, like, she's just driven.
But she's weird.
But it's true of a lot of them. But like, Pillow Talk, from how you've described it, is much more the, like, what then became of the romantic comedy, where the woman needs,
yeah,
to be, like, taken down a peg, or, like, you know, be brought off,
yeah,
her high horse or something.
Interestingly, when I was in university, the year that I started watching those melodramas,
mm,
we watched French Kiss,
mm-hmm,
which is a screwball comedy with Meg Ryan and Kevin Kline, in which she is this completely... I really hated that film, by the way. It was terrible. She is this very uptight, neurotic, and bitchy woman who is placated by a Frenchman.
Wasn't there a movie, a Ewan McGregor movie, that's like a...
Down with Love.
Is that any good?
I saw the start of it on TV once.
Maybe now that you've come to appreciate Pillow Talk, you should see it again. So,
well, I like Renee Zellweger. I know people, that's an unpopular thing to say. Renee Zellweger kind of, she was there when I was maturing into adulthood.
Well, good. I'm glad she was there for you. So, isn't there a bit in Pillow Talk where Rock Hudson is a straight man pretending to be gay, but in real life he is a gay man pretending to be straight?
Yes.
Is that, like, as fascinating as it sounds?
It is very fascinating, because you're thinking that whatever Rock is portraying on screen is probably, like, I was thinking, is this more or less than he would be off camera?
I bet he was probably just imitating Ross Hunter.
Do you think?
Well, because this is the dichotomy that I find so fascinating.
Well, he was imitating a Southern man, first of all.
Okay, so Ross Hunter's not from
But probably, you know, I mean, did Ross Hunter stick his pinky out as he was taking a drink?
Probably.
I mean, Ross Hunter was probably...
Have you seen his home?
Well, yeah. I mean, Ross Hunter was probably on set that day with the script editor being like, no. He would definitely put his pinky out.
Well, there are some men who just, they're very devoted to their mothers. You know, the type that likes to collect cooking recipes or exchange bits of gossip.
What a vicious thing to say.
Well, I hope I'm wrong, but don't you think you better make sure?
You are sick!
Tell me about your job. It must be very exciting working with all them colors and fabrics and all.
Ross starts out as an actor, isn't really particularly successful, and is kind of a blonde twink and, like, whatever, interchangeable, and becomes a producer, and is known as a fag, and is known for his love of gowns and jewels. Rock Hudson is square-jawed, barrel-chested. Yeah. He's Mask from Mask, right? And yet, their careers are so intertwined.
Yeah, and their names are so fucking similar.
Their names are similar, and as far as I know... I mean, I know there's been no comprehensive biography of Ross Hunter, but from what we've seen on the internet, like, they remained friends up until Rock's death from AIDS.
Yeah, this is really interesting.
And arguably, Ross Hunter is one of the people who arrived at Rock Hudson's house when the body was being taken away.
Yeah, that is unbelievable.
But see, that's what I mean is like...
Or is it? Is it just totally believable?
Here's the irony and the, like... Like, this is why it would make a fascinating Ryan Murphy, like, FX series. Like, forget Feud, Betty and Joan. I want to see Ross and Rock.
Yeah, I want to see a man make another man super famous and then deal with
By butching him up.
Yeah, and then be there to take his body out of his home during the AIDS crisis.
Okay, let's not give this idea to Ryan Murphy. Let's just write it ourselves. Okay. Yeah?
Okay.
Okay, sorry. I'll keep this in the podcast because I know Ryan Murphy's not going to listen to it.
I want to say one more thing.
Yeah.
In Cirque on Cirque, which is one of my favorite books about film, Douglas Sirk, we know he was a very talented and brilliant man, but he does say some things that were indicative of the time. He claims that Ross Hunter is the man who is fully responsible for turning Rock Hudson fully gay. Mm-hmm. And that Rock Hudson was definitely almost halfway there. But when he met Ross Hunter, he went all the way. That is something else, isn't it?
Well, that's the view of the time, that, like, people were, like, influenced by their mothers and by, like, predatory, you know, pansies. He may well have been anti-Nazi, but, you know, they all have flaws. But, I mean, he clearly worked with the man through all this time.
Exactly. 10 films is not for nothing.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
Okay, so Pillow Talk was a big highlight. Imitation of Life is one of your favorite movies. Do you just want to sell our audience who hasn't seen Imitation of Life on anything else about it? Like, what are the other iconic scenes?
Oh, or the final scene. The final scene, which we're not going to go into.
The funeral.
We can spoil something that was made 60 years ago, can we?
Yes, we can talk about the funeral. Here's my question. Is there any scene that involves Lana Turner and Sandra Dee? Like, do you actually like the whole movie, or do you just like the subplot?
No, let me tell you something. There's 2.5 plots in this film. The other plot, which emerges much later, and I really actually responded to it a little bit this time,
mm-hmm.
is Sandra Dee, who at the start of the film is played by a much younger child actress,
mm-hmm.
when Sandra Dee comes into the movie, the John Gavin character, who becomes present in her life again,
it's like her stepfather.
No.
Well, she's her mother's boyfriend.
But he leaves for years and years and years. And Sandra Dee, who is at home while her mother is off shooting a movie in Italy or something, falls head over heels in love
with her mother's boyfriend.
Now, how does this reflect real life?
Well, oh, yes, of course.
Because Lana Turner's daughter mm-hmm. shot dead her boyfriend.
Yeah, but I don't think she was in love with him.
No, but
in fact, I think she was arguably protecting her mother from abuse.
But there's a very funny part.
There's a really good, you must remember this, about the whole
trial. No, I'll go back and listen to it.
Yeah.
But John's really funny. There's one part where somebody in the film says something like, "But what do you know about Scandal, Laura?" for a role that she's playing. And, like, apparently that elicited so much laughter.
Well, but by this point...
Because Lana Turner was a scandalous actress.
Lana Turner obviously had gone through her kind of sweater girl phase and her, like, femme fatale phase. But
and
then,
Peyton Place, of course.
Well, but that's what I mean. Like, Peyton Place and The Bad and the Beautiful and this. By this point, she was known for Scandal from this murder trial of her mob lover by her daughter. I mean, like, yeah, we don't talk enough about Lana Turner. Like, Lana Turner was, like, the original, like, tabloid celebrity.
But we don't... Thing is, the reason we don't talk about Lana Turner, you and me, is because, ultimately, we don't think about her.
And because, honestly...
She wasn't that talented.
She was also, like, I'm gonna be a Judy Garland acolyte forever, and, like...
She was mean to Judy, wasn't she?
She was mean to Judy in, like, the MGM high school... She had big tits. She stole Mickey Rooney from Judy. Like, she was prettier.
And also, the thing about Lana Turner is that she is just a blonde woman.
She's like Regina George.
I have serious facial blindness to blonde women. Unless, of course, there's Sharon Stone.
Love! But you've always had that.
Yes, by telephone, by postcard, by magazine interviews. You've given me everything but yourself.
You're going to screen another Ross Hunter in a couple weeks' time that has Lana Turner, aren't you?
Well, I'm very excited about this.
How did you pick this one?
Well, it's a film that my mother and her sisters and brother can recount instantly.
Madam X.
Yes. Madam X was shown in our local cinema by my grandfather. And it is a film that you say the word Madam X and it brings back livid memories.
Vivid.
Sorry.
No, I like livid. No,
vivid memories.
They're livid.
Well, you know, livid also means like bruised and like battered.
Livid and bruised by Madame X.
Yeah.
I have to say, I had never heard of Madame X until Sean programmed it. But there is an extraordinary Pauline Kael review.
Which we will quote from.
Shall I quote from it now?
Choose the highlights, babe.
Okay. I'll just read
you. Can I give them the premise of it?
Yeah,
so basically. Madam X is a film that Ross Hunter made with no director of quality, meaning that he could essentially, you know, engage in his worst instincts. We talked about remakes. Madam X, I think this is the sixth remake of Madam X at this point. In this one, it is a vehicle for Lana Turner.
An aging Lana Turner.
And a seriously aging Lana Turner, her dresses, and... heavy makeup.
So, now, we all know how much we love Pauline Kael when she's bitchy, but, like, this is Pauline Kael at her bitchiest. So here she is. Madame X is apparently about a woman who has a child out of wedlock, gives it away.
Yeah, and then she marries into a well-to-do family in which they look down upon her.
And there's a murder that occurs.
There's a murder.
And then, ultimately, the lawyer defending her is...
Is Keir DeLay.
But it's... Her son, yeah. Who doesn't know is her son.
Keir DeLay, gone tomorrow.
This is my favorite paragraph from Pauline Kael's review of Madame X. At the opening of the film, a matronly-looking woman and a man of indeterminate age get out of a car in front of a mansion, and we realize they are supposed to be young newlyweds. She seems to be wearing a Lana Turner mask. But before we have time to react... They are greeted by what seems to be a young girl waiting at the door of the house to welcome them. The groom calls out, "Hello, mother." And then the youthful apparition comes close and we see, with horror, that she is wearing a Constance Bennett mask. There were gasps in the audience. Honestly, when Pauline Kael had it in for you, like, there was no escaping. But, so, I'm glad, Sean, in your program that you've programmed true masterpieces, like Imitation of Life. You've programmed really enjoyable camp classics, like Thoroughly Modern Millie, and great kind of fluffy comedies like Pillow Talk.
Yeah.
But then you've also included, like, complete dreck, like Madame X.
Because, yeah, it's important to do that.
And it's important to, like, represent that this man, Ross Hunter, like, he gave audiences what they wanted.
Yeah. And he also indulged in what he wanted,
yeah,
as well.
And he gave them lavish production values, decor, and he also, like, he kind of lasted too long, because I think by the time Pauline Kael is reviewing this Madame X,
he's a joke.
He's a joke,
yeah,
and his style of movie making was horribly outdated. But he then had one last hurrah.
He had one last hurrah, and he had his only Oscar nomination for Best Producer, Best Picture.
Yeah.
And that was Airport. And the interesting thing about Airport is it is by far his most mask of all films.
As mask as a film that features Maureen Stapleton and Jacqueline Bisset could be considered mask.
Fairly. I'm just delighted that I get to screen a Jacqueline Bisset film.
Scottish background to the front.
You know, Brian, Jacqueline Bisset taught me a lot of things. And she taught me that forgiveness is the best beauty treatment.
It's true. So Airport ushered in the kind of era of the disaster flick.
Airport gave us everything.
Mm-hmm.
It gave us Towering Inferno. It gave us the Poseidon Adventure.
United 93. Too soon. Sorry.
It gave us 2012. It gave us The Day After Tomorrow. It gave us everything that other homo Roland Emmerich is giving us now.
Okay, so ladies and gentlemen, if you have enjoyed this rambling, wine-fueled discussion of Ross Hunter, Sean, so assuming that they're listening to this the day this podcast is released, there are three Ross Hunter movies they can still see.
Yeah, tonight, 30 Modern Millie. See you there. Next Thursday, Madame X, you better be there. And the week after, on the 20th of December, our Christmas film, because there's snow, it's Airport.
Great. And so, if you missed the previous screenings, it sounds to me like the two highlights that you would say everyone should rent over the holiday festive season are Imitation of Life.
Absolutely.
And Pillow Talk.
Oh my god, yes.
Now,
if you watch Pillow Talk as a Christmas film, you will not be disappointed.
Can we conclude, just because it has such a special place in my heart, Thoroughly Modern Millie, which we are going to watch on the 6th of December.
Tonight.
Hopefully, yeah, tonight, with some of our beloved listeners. What is the plot of Thoroughly Modern Millie? So, let me say, it was then adapted into a Broadway musical by Janine Tesori, who, you know, has done wonderful work on Caroline or Change, and also Fun Home. But Thoroughly Modern Millie is not... Basically, they ironed out all the, like, politically incorrect and fun, campy elements.
Why mess with perfection?
The thing about Thoroughly Modern Millie is it's not perfection. Okay, here's the thing.
What?
When I watched... I think Thoroughly Modern Millie, I'm going to say it, it was my introduction to camp. Because I watched this film, as I said, it was a summer camp, like, assignment to, like, watch a movie about the 20s. And I was still, like, an earnest, dedicated student. I was like, I'm going to watch this movie and I'm going to learn about the 1920s. And I was like, wait a minute, this movie is, like, weird and overlong and, like, has these, like, rambling scenes and subplots that make no sense. Julie Andrews in this film, coming off the success of Mary Poppins and The Sound of Music, one of the biggest box office stars of the mid-60s, yeah? In big musicals. Universal decides they're going to make this big 1920s musical.
Who made Sound of Music, by the way?
Which studio?
Yeah.
Maybe 20th Century Fox. I don't know. But, I mean, it's a Robert Wise flick.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a big deal, The Sound of Music.
The Sound of Music.
Okay, so I don't know why you said it in that voice.
Because that's what Betty Davis
did
said.
Did she announce it?
No, it's do you remember when Robert Wise collected the Oscar?
Oh, sure.
And her
sure.
microphone was turned off. You know, I've been there.
Well, Robert Wise, I mean, you know, he directed West Side Story, he directed The Sound of Music. But so, big hit of 1965. Now, 1967 rolls around, and they're doing Thoroughly Modern Millie. In the film, Millie DeLmount, who is inexplicably English. Like, there is no explanation why this woman
Julie
is
Andrews
English.
Has never done an American accent.
No, and I mean, I guess, yeah. Why does Fraulein Maria have an English accent? Who knows? Anyway.
Well, why does no one have a German accent?
Yeah, exactly.
More appropriate.
But Millie Dilmount is a girl from, like, the Midwest. She's literally from,
I'm from Indiana.
No, she's like Milwaukee or somewhere.
Oh, it's so wonderful to be out of Milwaukee.
But she lives in the Priscilla Home for Young Ladies. So it's a hotel. It's a hotel that's only for single young women. And most of them are orphans because, as Beatrice Lilly says, so sad to be all alone in the world.
I thought she was so fucking scary.
Beatrice Lilly, I mean, I don't even know, other than in Thoroughly Modern Millie, who Beatrice Lilly is. I think she was a vaudevillian.
We saw her on a couple of posters. Remember, we went to the theater to see Company a while ago.
Beatrice Lilly is fucking amazing in this movie. She plays a woman named Mrs. Mears, who runs the Hotel Priscilla. And she is essentially a white woman who's obsessed with Chinese culture.
She's not doing yellow face.
I don't think so. Her name is Mrs. Mears. But she employs these two men from a Chinese laundry, one of whom is Patton Morita, otherwise known as Oscar nominee from The Karate Kid.
Oscar nominee Patton Morita.
Yeah, he plays Mr. Miyagi. So, in his young role. So she employs them as her, like, henchmen, who, like, drug the girls and put them in a laundry basket and sell them into white slavery.
Now, is Mickey Rooney selling people?
No, Mickey Rooney is not involved. But the reason that Millie is never drugged and sold is because she has a very big family back home in Wisconsin or Milwaukee or wherever she is. So Millie's plotline is all about how she's going to be a snog. I'm going to marry my boss. And who's her boss? It's none other than square-jawed John Gavin, who appears in, like, nearly every...
You mean the U.S. ambassador to Mexico?
Wait, John Gavin became the U.S. ambassador to Mexico?
Under your good friend Ronnie Reagan.
Well, that makes sense.
Actually, it would make a lot of sense, doesn't it?
To be honest, John Gavin could be the ambassador to anything that I own.
John Gavin can suck my dick.
He really can. He really could do a lot more, to be honest. And then also, he, like, helped Marion Crane get to the Bates Motel in Psycho.
Great. What happened to her?
Anyway, so Millie is in love with John Gavin, who's her boss. She becomes a snog. But then also, Mary Tyler Moore is a dippy heiress named Miss Dorothy Brown, who has all this money but is a poor orphan. And Carol Channing is a madcap heiress with a house on Long Island named Muzzy Van Hoffsmeer, who flies in an airplane, gets shot out of a cannon, and dances on a xylophone. Honestly, Sean.
Need you say more?
How can you not love this film? If you're free tonight, come see Thoroughly Modern Millie. If you're not, rent it over the holidays. Watch it with impressionable young people because they will be turned gay. And that's what we need in the world. The world is overpopulated. You need to homosexualize some people.
I'm with you, Brian.
But
I'm with you.
But here's the thing, Sean. What is my favorite scene in all of Thoroughly Modern Millie?
It's the line that is very quickly inserted through overdubbing. As Julie Andrews is walking away out of shot.
There's been a whole plot line that she's in the hotel with Mary Tyler Moore, and, like, there's all sorts of ups and downs, and there's mistaken identities and all stuff. And then for absolutely no reason to do with the plot, Julie Andrews kind of turns away, and clearly overdubbed, she says, "Don't forget, Miss Dorothy, I've got to go sing at that Jewish wedding tonight."
Yeah, but say that twice as fast.
"Don't forget, Miss Dorothy, I've got to go sing at that Jewish wedding tonight."
Yes, that's how short the amount of time she has to say it.
And they cut to, like, a literally 8-minute sequence in which Julie Andrews sings in mock Yiddish at a Jewish wedding where people are, like, wearing yarmulkes and dance the hora.
Mazel tov. 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 Mazel tov.
thing. Can you imagine Ross Hunter sitting at the desk being like, we gotta bring in the Jewish audience. Let's put this in. Yeah.
No, no, no. I told you, we need the Jewish scene. The whole film doesn't make sense without it.
I think it's from this wonderful period where Hollywood movies are trying to fight against television, and so their way of doing it is by just making everything bigger and longer.
Yeah, yeah, and that is exactly why Mark Harris's book is so good, because it shows you that Dr. Doolittle, that got an Oscar nomination for Best Picture, this absolute, you know, this absolute miasma.
Yeah, like Dr. Doolittle is like the complete apex of this terrible trend, but Thoroughly Modern Millie is like bizarre.
It's bizarre.
But it is at least entertaining.
Yeah.
Because it has brilliant comedy. It has great musical numbers. It has Julie Andrews singing chitty bim 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 by the lum. Hi yi 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 chitty bum bum. Chitty bum bum. Trink le chayim. Vive la hasafe. Trink le chayim. Mit a glass of wine. That's just
Stop.
A taste.
Stop.
That's just a taste. Thank you, Ross Hunter, for bringing that into our lives.
You know what? And thank you, listener.
This has been Broad Appeal
After Dark.
It really is. We've consumed an entire bottle of wine.
I think actually mostly it's been me, to be honest.
Ross would be proud.
Well, we should take some Quaaludes, I think, after this.
So, Shawnee, thank you for resuscitating the career of Ross Hunter.
And thank you for convincing me to do this podcast, Brian.
Yeah, and thank you for... I mean, I actually encourage you to, you know, do the whole Ross Hunter program as well.
Yeah,
you know,
say that.
I'm the man behind the man. I'm like...
Quite often.
Who am I? I'm like, in Imitation of Life, would I be...
No, you know who you are. You're the guy that Laura Meredith dates. You don't even remember who this is, do you?
No.
You haven't seen it. It's quite a handsome man with a mustache who wears a turtleneck.
Yeah,
he's and he's a playwright. Basically, it is you.
Okay, great.
Well, but she leaves him.
Fine. For John Gavin. That's fine. I would leave you for John Gavin.
Right.
So, ladies and gentlemen, we're nearly at the end of what has been an incredible year for Broad Appeal. And we have a treat coming up for you in a couple of weeks. It is the long-awaited audio release of Broad Appeal
Live. I'm very scared about this.
What are you scared about?
Well, I haven't listened to it.
Neither have I.
I was in the middle... I can't listen. Dear listeners, I want to preface this. I was in the middle of organizing a film festival. I can't even remember...
It's fine, Sean.
...a moment of it.
Honestly, Broad Appeal Live was a big success, not because of the two of us, because of our three brilliant panelists... Sean Fay,
Kimba Bob,
and Nat Lertzema.
Thank you, all three of
you. They did an amazing job. If you weren't there, you will get to hear it in a couple of weeks' time once I finally, you know, check through all the audio.
Yeah.
But that can be a Christmas present, or Hanukkah, or Eid, or Kwanzaa, or whatever it is that you celebrate, or just the winter solstice. We will give that to you. And will you give something to us, please? Give us a rating or a review, or more importantly... Get your friends and your relatives to subscribe. Sean, do you know there are 60 episodes of this shit that we've been putting out?
And we don't even have a Patreon page.
60 episodes entirely for free. What could you give us? You could at least, you know, get someone else to subscribe. They could have hours and hours of enjoyable content to partake
in. I want to be famous. Can't you just help me be
all right,
famous?
Lana Turner, I'll just be Juanita Moore. You know, in the original one, is she an actress or does she like start
she steals a pancake
a chain
recipe.
Of pancake recipes?
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
It is very interesting, but I don't want to see it tonight.
Okay. We're going to go watch some other movie.
RoboCop.
And drink more wine. Sean says RoboCop. I probably say something by Merchant Ivory. Who will win? All right. Follow us on Twitter. We're at Broad Appeal Pod. I'm at BA Mullen Speaks.
And I'm at Sean McGovern X. And Brian, I want to give you a big Christmas kiss.
Aww.
Here.
Mwah. All right, ladies and gentlemen. Ross Hunter has brought us together. And the diamonds are forever.
Goodbye. That was very entertaining, Brian.
There's going to be no editing of that.
What is love without the giving? Without love, you're only living an imitation of life. Sky as above, in flaming color. Without love, there's so much duller, a false creation, an imitation of life.